Meeting will come to order. And I should say for the record, because there's been a little bit of confusion, given the fact that we've planned this just on the same day that we moved the bonding bill back to conference committee, there's no connection with the hearing today.
There's not.
and that bonding bill moving forward. I think some people had thought it meant we were trying to move some language into it, but it was pure coincidence. We had planned this hearing for a couple of weeks ago when we knew there were some policy bills, so just to clarify. And Representative Kahn has another committee that she's chairing, so we'll just quickly move to her. And I'll tell you, members, we'll hear from Representative Kahn and then the Gardner, Anderson, and Downey bills, and then we've asked a couple of the departments to comment generally on some of those ideas, but after the authors have had a chance to describe bills. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. You all have in your packets something that looks like this. And so you should pull it out. And what it is, and you can actually see something related to Minnesota if you go to a website, just Google Min Recovery. I don't know what the exact website is. And what happened was that with the requirement for transparency, and particularly in the ARRA bill, the stimulus bill, is that a website was developed from MinGeo and from the Department of Finance and so forth to set up, and the website is spectacular. The Minnesota one was rated as one of the four best in the country. I don't know if it was the fourth best or one of the four, but four is pretty good anyway. And so one of the things that we had said when we first saw it and we opened it's so much fun to play with. You can go to a location and you can look at what's in that location on the map. You can go to a subject like environment or housing or something like that, and you can hit that and an icon comes up and it shows you where it is. It's very accurate, and it's very very user-friendly. It's very useful to state government and user-friendly to people. And so one of the things, as soon as we saw it, he said, okay, why can't we do the whole budget like this? And people just turned pale talking to it. And apparently the budget computerization of the budget is not in the best shape anyway. So then he said, okay, what can we do? And the three things we decided that we could do is that we could do the capital bonding bill, and then the other bill this year is the LCCMR bill, and eventually the legacy bill, too, in terms of being able to do it. And this is an example of Maryland, and so you can go check it out and play with that, with the statestat. The homepage is statestat.maryland.gov. And Washington, and this is their capital bonding bill. So you have it in your thing, and it has the, and you can see it has the kind of project that it is in one color. We had to go find a color Xerox because you can't really show this in black and white at all. And you have to, and so again, it shows exactly where they are in the state, and you can zoom in and zoom out, and you can get to the subjects, and you can get to individual projects too. Since then, we learned that State of Washington plans to roll out a new StatStats website later this spring, and that will add the capital budget to the ARRA. And so the talking to other GIS coordinators and GIOs, Geographic Information Organizations, Oregon and Delaware are going to be doing it too. And the way we want to fund this costs maybe $100,000 for the whole, you know, for the whole project, and the way we want to fund it is we want to fund it on a bill back to the projects. We don't want to put it into the projects because it would like be 0.00001% or something like that. So it doesn't make, but the ability to be able to map the projects by taking money from the projects is a really easy way of funding it.
And if you,
so we're putting the language in. We're putting the language in our bill. And there won't be funding associated with it. It will come through the various bills that make these appropriations.
So she's coming to us for information only. As she indicated, the language is going to be in her bill. I don't know when that moves, but it is for information of this particular group. Now, Representative Kahn, we did think that on a couple of, if you just think about a couple of big items in our bill, local bridges and all the public facilities authority projects, WIF, et cetera, that often those we don't know what's actually going to get funded until after the fact.
The one I kind of thought about was metro and regional parks and something like that. So you might have one symbol that goes right in the middle of the metropolitan air. You know, I talked about this with David Arbeit, who's the person who does that. And so you'd have some general symbol when you started. For bridges and roads, you just have, you know, this is a statewide funding, and you'd have some indication of that. And then as the projects are funded and decided on, you can then put the specific pinpoint into where they're going. And the explanation would tell you, then tell you where it came from.
And we have the map, and then you have a statement in our packet from David Arbeit as well that gives a website, should they wish to. So that is for your information. It will not be in our bill, but it will be in Representative Kahn's
And I
bill.
Do suggest that people who are more interested in Minnesota than Maryland that you look at the Min Recovery site.
And I don't know if you still wanted to collect the...
No, we don't. Okay. It turns out we do have a way to do colors there. Okay. First, I thought we had to go off to Kinko's to do it, but it turns out we don't.
Thank you so much.
Even if we don't have them in our individual offices, we do have access.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Gardner.
Madam
We're not
Chair?
Spending... is the question
no,
for
Representative No. I'd move the minutes of... someday here.
Of
February 9th.
February 9th. Minutes, discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those minutes are adopted. Thank you. Representative Gardner, and you can see we have a full agenda, so we're not spending a huge amount of time. And these next three bills, the fiscal notes have not arrived for them yet. The Anderson bill, there is a fiscal note that was just completed today, but we don't have that in our packets either. So that piece of information we don't have, but well, welcome to the committee, and please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't really know how you wanted to dispose of these bills, which are kind of overlapping, so I'm just flattered to have the informational hearing at all and just pose some ideas for you to think over.
Except for one, House File 3492, that's the only bill we're moving out. The others we're just holding. As all of you know, this I don't know if any of the three authors have Senate authors. The Senate has not been as interested in policy generally. And in the case of several of the policies that we're looking at today, they were in the bill, and the governor, in meeting with us, had indicated a wish that they not be in that bill. And so one of the things we had thought about is just hear a variety of policies and then maybe determine as a committee would we want to send a separate policy bill. So that's the purpose for the hearing today.
Great. And thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the time. We've discussed this a little bit last year. I actually introduced House File 2182 last year. And actually, since that was introduced, I see from the capital budget request instructions for public entities and local governments that MMB has actually included some of the kinds of information there. So that actually would be preferable than doing something in statute. But the purpose of the bill was really to... engage taxpayers a little bit more into what the capital investment bill is and what it is not. I know every 2 years you put together a bill and people have some assumptions about what it actually is and debt management and what the value of the projects are and so on. I don't think any of that debate is going to go away, but I think it would help build trust among taxpayers, particularly in districts like the ones that Representative Downey Anderson and I represent, who really never have anything in it but often pay for it, that having some more transparency about the value of the projects would be helpful. And so I've just listed some ideas of what those could be so that when we do get to actually deliberating the bill, you could have something in a spreadsheet format that allows us to compare things. I originally had an idea about a cost-effectiveness index, but I think that was totally unwieldy because you know, unlike the transit projects at the Federal Transit Authority, you're not comparing apples to apples. You're comparing a trail to a building to a roof to a heating and cooling system, and you really just can't rank anything. There's nothing in the bill that would say that the legislature or the executive branch must apply any of these criteria for any purpose. So there's nothing preventing the legislature from choosing projects that it wants and leaving out ones that it doesn't want, and it doesn't prevent the executive branch from recommending or not recommending specific projects. It simply allows the public to take some of the information that we know is already out there about purported employment numbers, energy savings, whether a building is being brought up to code, and having that all in one place. And again, I think a lot of that information is already out there. It would ask MMB to collect that information, but I would assume that they would then ask the applying entities for that information so that the state wouldn't be really doing a lot of the investigation, if you want to call it that. If you were to take action on this bill later, Madam Chair, I'd suggest we get rid of Section 2, which just has when we would apply the criteria. It's obviously out of date. But that's pretty much it. I know you have lots of other pressing items, but I just wanted to offer that as one issue for your consideration.
Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, we have time to press you a little bit first.
And press or press?
Either way.
Okay.
I'm just wondering how long you would expect MMB to take to do a criteria analysis of a project.
Madam Chair, I would, Representative Erdahl, I would actually assume that they would really ask the applying entities who want the money to say, here's the information, and MMB would essentially put it in a format that you can digest as you consider recommendations from MMB. So my goal would not to be have MMB spending a lot of time actually coming up with complicated formulas. You'd rely on the interested entities who want the money to provide that information.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, then you're anticipating that they would be able to act quickly. What I'm getting at is, if there are relatively emergency type projects, suddenly a flood mitigation need, or let's just say that there's an opportunity for a business to be established, but it had to be dealt with quickly, would under your criteria, would this be able to be done?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, perhaps not literally, but if it were to move forward, I think we should all entertain that notion. Certainly, if you have something like flood mitigation in the near term, you may need to have some sort of emergency kick-out clause. And in case there, when we decide to site the Dean Erdahl Boyhood Home and Literary Museum in Grove City, that would be in a bill by itself. I don't know how you'd have any criteria to apply to that. Madam Chair, I was also going to mention, too, that there is an exemption here in Subdivision 1B. If there's an agency that already has some sort of transparent and objective methods, and I think the best example is the Public Facilities Authority ranking system, which I've seen on environmental finance, where they actually they have a point system to figure out which systems are in the greatest need and for what reasons. And so Minsky is another example where they prioritize things.
And local bridges, I think.
And local bridges. Those would be three examples where there probably is something already. However, I'm not on this committee, and I think you've seen the projects. I think the members can probably figure out how you would do this. So I don't want to profess to being the expert in this area by any means, but I just offer it as a suggestion from the people who are putting the bill.
Okay. No further questions. I think we are finished. We'll just hold this and all of these and then we're going to a little later have both Jeff Freeman and MMB come forward and just give us their own reflection on the variety of policies that we've heard today, just from their work, so that we understand what other issues there might be that are not clear to us.
Thanks for the opportunity, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Representative Anderson is here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you taking time from your schedule to hear my bill. But I just wanted to start off the day. I remember a time in the legislature where freshman legislators in particular were asked to bring a tree to the committee members, and I think that's a good tradition. And though I'm not a freshman member, I wanted to share with you a little sustenance for the day. And it's, I in particular chose the Payday candy bar because we're talking about jobs here today. So if you would, just pass those around.
Well, I think this might be a first. I can't remember that anyone's ever come to the Capital Investment Committee before, so you're Representative Junkie.
Speaking from the ag perspective, we always encourage food in the ag committee and get it quite often. So.
Very good. Thank you. Madam Chair, I'll just be brief. What my bill does essentially is it asks that we have an idea of what jobs are created or retained through the bills that we pass as part of the bonding process. And we've had this debate on the House floor. My goal is that we are more informed as legislators of what happens as a result of our actions. And that's it in a nutshell. I can give you greater detail if you'd like, but I just wanted to give you an opportunity to ask questions if you have any.
And what we've specifically asked Jeff Freeman to do today is just give us their experience from the federal. They were required to keep some of these records, and we thought we might learn something about that process from the perspective of what they needed to do.
Sure. And Madam Chair, just to maybe kind of hit things on the front end too, my intent with this bill is not to add an extra burden to state agencies. I've talked to the Department of Administration. I've let them know that I view this as something that they could include as a requirement in those vendors that we contract with, that they have to provide that information on the front end. So it's part of the contract that we have that they provide that information so as not to provide a burden to our state agencies.
This is Representative Clark. Do you have
a question? I'm just trying to find the bill here. But do you also ask
House File 3105. Oh, no, that's Downey. I'm sorry, I have the wrong one. 2909.
Yes, are you also checking here on the, you do have pay ranges. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because I think, you know, that's a really important part of understanding the wages that are being created by these jobs. Mm-hmm. Do you have we do have some language in the statute that talks about living wage jobs. So I'm just wondering, do you have a range schedule in mind here? Or?
I don't, and Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I'd be more than happy to work with you if you have some ideas on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howard.
I do have a question or maybe a suggestion. Representative Mahoney can help me here if I make any major mistakes, but in the world of construction and building buildings, the bidding process is one of the highest pressure things that you do to get it. You bid it as best you can to pay your workers, buy the material, and make somewhat of a profit. I'm sure that the state agencies will pass this down to the general contractor. The general contractor will ask the plumbing contractor, the heating contractor, electrical contractor to keep track of how many man hours, and what pay range. An electrical contractor, if Mahoney is hired to put pipe in, and they're going to track how many hours and how many men did it and how much they got paid, the general contractors is want to know why it was only $160,000 and the bid was $500,000. And it creates a problem. And it might create transparency in the bidding process, but it's also going to create problems in the bidding process. So there needs to be a way that you can do it, maybe total man hours, but not, and total cost, but not necessarily the wage per hour. Some way to, am I wrong, Representative Mahoney? I've been here a little longer.
I didn't even think about that when it. No, actually, I think we're about the same length of time.
Yeah.
And there's the infamous story of, and this is a public project I won't mention by name. They bid the whole job out, pulling pipe down a mile and a half tunnel, and they came along and by the luck of the draw, the top was off the tunnel, and he got to drop all the pipe in without dragging it, and took them about 150 hours versus 1,500 hours. All of a sudden, that would have created more problems than it was worth, almost, if the state had tried to figure that out.
It's a problem that needs to be worked on, and I certainly don't have the answer.
Again, Madam Chair, Representative Howes, if you've got ideas of how that could be addressed, please feel free to let me know.
Okay, thank you very much. Before we go on to the next, I'm going to jump down the agenda because this happens to be Steelworkers Day at the Capitol. And so that we have people in the audience, and one of them is from International Falls. There may be some others. And he wants to get home yet tonight. And so I think we're going to move this discussion up. You may remember, I think the amendment was not added in this committee, but Representative Rukavina added an amendment. I cannot recall if it was in this committee or in finance. That was one of the items that the governor referenced in terms of policy language that gave him some trouble in the bonding bill, and so we removed it from there. But I did think it was worth having a discussion because I do believe this language was fairly carefully drafted, and they're going to talk with us a little bit about that, and I think they might even be able to tell us which states have already adopted either this language or something similar. So I don't have a name of, is it Dave is not?
David Hallis.
David Hallis, okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is David Hallis with Steelworkers Local 7263. We represent a little over the 400 members in three different shops. And two SEIU staff locals. I work full-time at the Gerdau Ameristeel Steel Mill in St. Paul. And why buy American? Buy local. We can't think of a better way to show companies in the state and the country that we appreciate them doing business here and keeping Minnesotans and Americans employed than by purchasing the products they produce. One thing to consider, we use tax breaks, credits, and low-interest loans to help businesses. But using Buy American, Buy Local, you're not taking any money off the bottom line of the state since you're using those dollars in the first place.
I'm going to interrupt for just a minute, members. We have the language in your packet. It was the Rukavina Amendment. It's 2054. And right following that are two handouts that I believe were provided by you that give a little bit of information from, I think, Boston and Michigan?
Correct.
And so if you're, if you want to have those three before you, please continue.
Okay. What we're doing here is simply asking to make it state policy to give preference to manufacturers that help generate the revenue to the state in the first place. Main reason we're pushing for this is the workers who make the construction products want to make them for their communities. They're watching who's getting the bids. They want the state to support workers and companies who make good quality products and sell it at market prices. We got two handouts in front of you. The one is the Supreme Court case, and the other is an executive directive by Governor Granholm of Michigan, which was signed in 2004. It has Buy American, Buy Local provisions in it. First question usually get asked is this legal? Even though the Supreme Court case in front of you deals with hiring local workers, that explains very well how a state or local government would or would not be in violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. The Buy American, Buy Local provision would only affect purchases made by the state with state dollars and would not be a market regulation, therefore making Buy America, Buy Local constitutional. 26 states currently have preferences for state bidders, products grown or manufactured in their states. Maybe only certain areas or certain projects, but Michigan is by far the most aggressive with its Michigan First program, claiming 90% of the contracts they award going to Michigan companies. And lastly, I would like to bring up the environmental impact of this is greatly ignored. If you're buying a product from a country that has weak or no environmental standards, and the way that product is manufactured would violate our own environmental laws, we would be weakening our efforts to reduce our own carbon footprint while holding Minnesota companies to a higher standard. I'd like to open it up for any questions.
Questions? So, in other words, you're identifying this as our competition is another country and not another state.
Yeah.
And when you use the term local, that's intentionally not, you don't define that as Minnesota.
No.
So it could be Duluth using a superior company, for example.
Yeah, it could be regional. It could be, you know, whatever legislature decides would do the best for Minnesota.
And do I recall hearing that the governor of Colorado has acted on this?
With Colorado, they do have some preference laws, but what they did was the Buy American to deal strictly with stimulus dollars. It was attached to the Recovery Act. I believe there's seven states that do have the buy local and buy small business provisions broadly, but I don't have that list in front of me at the moment. So I know Michigan is definitely the one who's in the forefront on that.
I thought it was important to have him today because I think you know, some feel that this isn't workable, but your experience is that this is really not an exception to the rule anymore, that there are a number of states who have moved ahead. And clearly, you may recall when we talked about our Duluth experience where they were proud to tell us they had used, for the most part, Minnesota companies. I think everyone feels so keenly that when we're putting these taxpayer dollars to work, that we hope we're also literally changing the economy of the state and nation as well.
Correct.
Questions? Did you want to speak? You want to speak to this?
Please.
Okay. We have questions of the gentleman here? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please come forward. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Justin Kaufman, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Department of Administration. Madam Chair Chipperson, thank you for the opportunity. I want to be really clear that I'm not here to talk about the policy. I think this is a well-intentioned policy, and what I'm here to talk about is the concerns from the Department of Administration standpoint for implementing the policy to make sure that the concerns we have are ones that you understand and that they may be some of the same concerns that you have. One of the issues and one of my understandings and the reason for this bonding bill is in some way to get people working, to really sort of get things moving. Let me start with this. I guess what I'm saying here is I understand the critical nature of streamlining the delivery of these bonding projects or bonded projects, and we just want to make sure that we express our concerns so that we can get rid of the challenges that may slow down or impede the progress on these projects. So let me start and just go down a simple list, and I'll try not to stumble over my words. From the implementation process, we see some significant areas, not only in time and money to implement, and that may also delay the process. It looks like the provision that is currently that we're currently talking about is really modeled after the ARRA provisions that are out there, the federal rehabilitation provisions. But there are some noticeable differences, and some of those differences are really what cause us some concern. There are no exceptions, for example, when an award is inconsistent with the public interest. There are no exceptions related to compliance with international trade agreements. As the state of Minnesota is sort of secondary signatory to the World Trade Organization, a governmental purchasing act, that prohibits us from discriminating against other WTO members in the solicitation of large projects. There's some issues there that just have not made its way into the current bonding bill. The other issue is that under the AARA, the similar language that we have, the federal government has established about 12 pages of policies and procedures that tell the government agencies how to implement this that act. That is sort of the rules behind it and what needs to be done. Sort of the simple things we were talking about earlier, for example, how we identify local workers. There's really no clear definition of local workers. There's no clear definition of the intent of whether that means Minnesota, whether that means regional, whether that means national. And it's those types of rules that are missing from the process that are going to create some significant burden. And our concern is that this is going to slow down the process of getting these projects out the door. Now, the other issue that was raised, and that's the local preference, and I don't want to really get into to too much of what was already raised, but the local preference really doesn't come from the AARA model. That seems to come from another spot. And although numerous states have preferences that they've established for various areas, there are also 34 other states that have basically reciprocal punishment to Minnesota businesses if we are to, for example, give preference to Minnesota businesses. And that includes all of our bordering states.
And I think that's why they specifically avoided reference to state. Is my understanding is that very point.
And that's very possible. My concern is, again, since we don't have any definition or guidance on what local means, we're left to interpret that, and where does that leave us? And so, again, really it's somewhat of a lack of the detail or lack of the promulgated rules sort of surrounding this that give us pause, as well as some of the exceptions in the AARA that don't seem to be present here. That's really all the comments I have related to the Buy American provision, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And listening, what I heard is that you say the concept is workable, but the language has some implementation challenges. Is that a summary?
I don't want to speak sort of above my level of saying the language is workable. I'd rather...
The concept is workable. Language is...
I think the concept is well-intentioned. The language gives us some concerns from an implementation standpoint and concerns and delays of getting these projects out the door and the unnecessary delays that may occur. And so I think that's another aspect, not only from an internal administrative standpoint, but also from the standpoint of affecting Minnesota business that's trying to get these projects moving.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is one of those issues we'd spent quite a bit of time on along the way, and perhaps we could have some more conversation after that testimony. So, reverting back, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the chance to bring this forward. I appreciate your honoring my request from the floor when I offered this as an amendment to actually draft it into a bill and have it heard. So thank you very much for the chance to come before you. So this is another bill attempting to put an additional level of analysis to the bonding projects that are requested of the state on an ongoing basis as information to policymakers and the public. Similar to Representative Gardner's bill, this would not dictate any kind of decision making on the part of this body or the legislature or the governor, simply to provide additional information and a level of analysis that would be more comparable to what you might see in terms of capital project requests in the private sector. So what I attempted to do here was require MMB and other relevant stakeholders to actually fine-tune a document that would be an analysis framework that would be required of all bonding project requests to the state on an ongoing basis after June 30th of next year. And the intent here is, I'll just walk very quickly through the provisions of the bill, and then I have Dr. Spry from the University of St. Thomas, who's done a lot of work with public value calculations on capital projects, to offer a couple of comments as well. But the thought here is that we would require the requesters to document, at least to whatever extent they can, the value of the project, and specifically on lines 1.12 through 1.15, asking them to try and articulate some outcomes, some things that we might actually see as a result of the project. Value in terms of capital projects in the public sector is a mysterious thing. What is the value of keeping dangerous criminals off the street? Those are things that you can't necessarily quantify, so this isn't intending to drill everything down to some kind of a dollar ROI, although Dr. Spry can tell you there's ways to do some of that in lots of different cases. It could be just as simple as saying we're going to have safer streets, or we'll keep, you know, sex offenders locked up for X number of years, whatever the value of the project might be. But on the cost side, very commonly in the private sector, you'd really do a 10-year total cost of ownership of a project, not simply look at the initiation or the construction acquisition cost, but actually model out the ongoing operating costs of the project. So we'd really have a longer-term view to present to decision-makers here at the Capitol about what the cost of this project is, what the ongoing cost to taxpayers might be, what the funding sources are, and then also try and model revenue derived from the project as well. And I was going to reference Representative David's. One of his projects actually came in with something fairly comparable to this. One of his projects showed the ongoing life of the project, the number of shows, the revenues, the people that would be hired, those kinds of things. So that was actually an example of a project that kind of fit the bill here. So one other provision that I thought might be somewhat novel is that if there really is a substantial return on investment to a project, perhaps the project requesters might even be willing to take some of that ongoing revenue and pay back some of the bond proceeds, some of what they borrowed, as a gesture of good faith to the state to show their confidence in it, in a way to kind of have a good partnership there. And then very importantly, from my perspective, part of the debate we had on the floor, and we've been having actually a fairly robust debate in the tax committee too, is, you know, what's the opportunity cost, the cost of displacement? I heard that term used today. So if we do this, and yes, we recognize that there might be some jobs or economic benefit, what isn't going to occur in the broader economy by way of this bonding project actually being initiated? So with that, I will hand it over to Dr. Spry, who's done quite a bit of this and might have some additional information to add, and then stand for questions if you have any. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is John Spry. I'm an associate professor in the Opus College of Business in the Finance Department of the University of St. Thomas.
Chair Members, House, you do have his testimony in your packet.
Yeah. Chair Houseman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My written testimony has been handed out, which is about 4 pages. And I'm going to sort of go through the bullet points on the first page, and you may wish to ask more questions. In general, in my opinion, House File 3105 is a good government proposal. It requires a specific list of information to be provided so that there can be a better understanding of the net return on investment, and that analysis would be made available to the legislature and the public. And when you think of capital budgeting, there's two types of mistakes that could be made, whether you're looking at government capital budgeting or a private company. And the first type of mistake is to make the people of the state poor by not pursuing a project that has a positive rate of return that's greater than the opportunity cost of funds. So this is when the stream of benefits from the project, discounted back into today's dollars, is larger, and sometimes maybe significantly larger, than the stream of costs associated with the project, also discounted back into today's dollars. And so I think about this as not drafting Adrian Peterson. If you have the opportunity to do a really great project and you don't do it, that's a type one mistake. A type two mistake would be to make the citizens of Minnesota poor by approving a project that has a negative net present value. That is, when you take all of the benefits And I like one thing in the Gardner bill was an idea. If you have a project that has cost savings because you're going to be more environmentally efficient in heating or in cooling, something like that, that's going to provide a stream of benefits. So you take all those benefits, you also take the cost, and if you have a project that's like the Herschel Walker trade, where to Minnesota, you do get something back. You get Herschel Walker. So you have a project that has some benefits, but in today's dollars, the opportunity cost of what you give up a lot. And in general, the way to try to avoid these mistakes is to employ the tools of capital budgeting, and both at the University of St. Thomas, the University of Minnesota, our higher educational institutions, people in business programs, MBA programs, also masters of public policy programs, learn how to do what's called benefit cost analysis and capital budgeting. And there's a former state lawmaker and president, Abraham Lincoln, that has a nice quote about the value of this that I think applies to just about everything this committee would consider. There are few things wholly evil or wholly good. Almost everything, especially of government policy, is an inseparable compound of the two, so that our best judgment of the preponderance between them is continually demanded. So the idea of Representative Downey's House File 3105 is to provide better information. In my written testimony, I have a list of six things I think should be included on the second to last page in a net return on investment analysis. These are entirely standard things that you would find in any textbook on capital budgeting or on benefit cost analysis. A few final notes. I think it's important that the organization performing a rate of return investment cost-benefit analysis be respected by the public in the legislature. So in addition to the list of the state economist and management and budget and Representative Downey's bill, I think you might want to consider the legislative auditor, who I think has an outstanding reputation for independence, and perhaps even more importantly, has tremendous expertise within their office on the project evaluation and program evaluation tools that could be used here. And so that's my oral comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Spry. Are you suggesting that we should rate capital bonding projects by a cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, that I might put benefit cost first. That's the academic standard of putting it. I think that would be really good. I think it would actually show more light on debates and try to reduce the volume of heat. One other thing I should add is that I like about the Downey bill is the deadline gives over a year to put this into place. So this isn't something for this year's bonding bill, but allows for time to develop this system of benefit cost analysis.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Spry, I'm struck by your comments about the people of the state shouldn't be made poor. Keeping in mind that being poor or rich is a very subjective term. Are you suggesting, for example, that we should not invest in state parks, since I think it's a rare state park that actually makes money for the state?
Cost-benefit analysis, and I have references to some of the standard texts on the second to last page, would not immediately lead to the conclusion that a state park always has a cost that is greater than the benefit. There are entire journals, like the Journal of Tourism Economics, that have example after example where you can use surveys and also look at how far people are willing to travel to go to a park, and be able to put some measure on the value of a park. based on what people say is their willingness to pay for the park. I didn't have to pay to go to this park, but, you know, this park is really nice, and you have visitor counts, you have survey results, or what's called the travel cost method, and this is pretty standard and well-known both in business schools and public policy schools.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Just finishing up then. So, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Spry, you are not saying that all benefit is necessarily financial?
Very much so. A standard thing you would learn, I think, in any economics course at St. Thomas is benefits may be financial and non-monetary, non-financial, and costs may be the same way. And the whole idea of cost-benefit analysis is to try to quantify some costs, which are maybe really easy to identify, the monetary costs, non-monetary benefits and costs as well.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erdahl. I think these are great questions because, you know, fundamentally, government is not a business. I mean, this is a political process. The capital investment bill is a political bill, and I get that. We all get that. And yet the intent here of this bill is to pull in some analytical tools that would, I think, help everybody really fully understand the proposer's understanding of the value of the project, a maybe more refined and comprehensive understanding of its costs and ongoing costs and the resulting economic benefits, and just bring some of those private sector tools to the table for the political decision-making process. And again, in the public sector, the definition of public value is one of art and science, and the hope is that we bring a little bit of science to the table as well.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Spry, I certainly acknowledge and recognize that kind of analysis that you're suggesting could be helpful in many instances. What I'm wrestling with here, though, is that all the different projects that are in the bonding bill are very different kinds of projects. And, for example, how would you deal with the project that requires 50% local funding? How do you deal with that when the state is paying half of the cost associated with the project and the state is not responsible for ongoing operations of that project? How do you factor that in to this whole analysis?
Mr. Spry.
Chair Hausman, members of the committee, Representative Lanning, I actually have some experience with something a little bit different. In 2005 and 2006, the Legislative Council of Indiana commissioned me and some fellow economists to do a benefit cost study of a government policy for the state of Indiana. And so in doing benefit cost analysis, sometimes, as was the case with this study, you're limited to what are the benefits to a particular geographic location, like a state, and what are the costs. So in that study, we did not include additional benefits, for example, to people outside of that state. So when you have a project that has a mixture of local and state funding, you could have a cost-benefit analysis done from the perspective of, say, a city or a county, that whatever the relevant local benefit area is, and also from the perspective of the state. And that's pretty standard practice that's known to the cost-benefit community, both in business schools and public policy schools.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another situation that I have trouble understanding, being a college guy myself, how do you do this kind of analysis on college buildings where you know, the state owns the campus, you need a library to be renovated or upgraded? How does this kind of analysis work in a situation like that?
Mr. Spry.
Well, I work at St. Thomas. I'll do an easy example and then a little bit harder example. An easy example, it was not government, it was the private sector. The University of St. Thomas a few years ago opened a new dormitory. and as part of the decision-making at the president's staff level for a new dormitory, that's really, in some ways, sort of easy. You can measure the benefit as that stream of cash flow, that if we open this dorm, right. There, for people in St. Paul, actually, there are now a little bit fewer St. Thomas students living in the neighborhood and having wild parties. That may be, right, you could figure in what is that worth. You may, for example, talk to the police in that city and see, you know, if we could get some of these college students to be better behaved in the neighborhood, that has value. So there, right, you have a very defined stream of benefits. For another project, I'll pick something near and dear to my heart, such as, say, a new facility for an economics department. Or College of Business. Usually there's what are called internal chargeback rates or transfer pricing rates where a department using 10,000 square feet for classroom and offices internally in a university setting is paying the university an internal transfer price. Money never leaves the university, but it's a way of sort of pricing out internally the value of the use of this building for the business school versus a school of social work. And so for those types of buildings, you would do it that way. For a library, again, it's pretty easy, and there are pretty standard methods to try to put a value on how many people are using it, what's the value per user, a little bit of multiplication, and you have better information than I think is provided routinely for every request.
Well, Representative Lamming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to finish up, I certainly understand a residence hall is an easy example to apply this approach. But when you're talking about a system and a program such as you mentioned, a new economics or whatever, what has to be considered here is how does that fit in all of the other economics programs at all the other institutions within the system. And it seems to me that this gets very complicated, and I'd be interested to see how Minsky would take that suggestion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Representative Erdahl. He asked my question only, what the answer was parks, and you pay for parks, and I was thinking about trails where we would not want people to pay for trails, but I'm wondering since I love measurable outcomes, if we wouldn't be better off having big categories where we say for trails these are the benefits and these are the costs, rather than doing each individual project. It would take us forever to get a bonding bill put together.
Sounds like a suggestion.
I just wanted to briefly respond.
Mr. Spry.
Chair Hausman. I wasn't saying for parks that it's what you pay, but the technique that's sometimes used, the survey-based technique, is you might ask people, and I'm going to just pick a park I enjoy from time to time, Canal Park in Duluth. I really enjoy that park, and when I go there, I actually have traveled a long distance, and that indicates it's worth some value to me. But if you were to do a survey a couple times a year after a park is established and ask how much is this park worth to you, and you multiply by that, you sort of get a number. And secondly, this is one of the reasons why, even though these techniques of benefit-cost analysis are very well established in the literature, I think it's important to have a very reputable independent voice do whatever analysis is done so that people sort of throughout Minnesota have trust in it.
Just one final comment, and I think we're unearthing a big pile of complexity possibly. I think my intention in the bill is that from my own experience sitting on the higher ed committee and looking at the 24 Minsky projects and another 24, I think it must have been 50 bills we saw. The ones that made it the easiest for me to make a good decision were the ones that had some additional information about what the total costs of these things were, where the local matches were coming, what the jobs impact might be, the number of students affected, the way the program would, you know, lay into the overall university system. So the intention of this bill is that we'd provide an additional set of data to people, to decision makers here. Again, not to supersede this committee or any other committee making a decision about the relative value and merits of projects, but to give us another set of information to make better decisions on those relative merits and arbitrate those decisions based on some facts. So anyway, I appreciate the time. If there's other questions, we could stand for them, but I appreciate
I
having
have
the chance.
Two more, I think. Representative Carlson and Representative Rick Ravina.
Madam Chair, no, we're up my way. We're going through a cost-benefit analysis for Bottineau Boulevard, but what comes to mind is a big question is what the criteria is that you can ask for to often determine the outcome when you're
sure.
doing a calculation by that. But I wanted to do a follow-up to Representative Lanning's question dealing with education. And I was listening carefully when you referenced like a dormitory or a new building for economics. When you're figuring the cost-benefit analysis, you know, there's the one way you could look at it is the subsidy we provide to St. Thomas indirectly through aid to students and so on, and their use of the building. And should that be the measurement, or should it be the other revenue that perhaps has come in through donors and so on, as we look at it from our standpoint, because we don't really approve the building, but we do indirectly help pay for it through subsidized tuition and so on by the students. And more importantly, I was thinking about the U of M, and there, of course, there's the three missions, education, research, and outreach. And if we're going to do a cost-benefit analysis with research, you know, we're often told that sometimes those investments in facilities and labs and so on, and then the research dollars take a long time before they really begin to pay a dividend. Some of that basic research might be in the pipeline for years and years before they have a breakthrough and a discovery and issue patents and that kind of thing. So I'm just trying to get a handle on the long range, especially when we talk about areas in research. And if you want to comment about the indirect subsidy at a St. Thomas or a Concordia, where you used to be a Representative Lanning, how you would measure that and what you should measure is really what I'm asking. Should we measure the subsidy to students, or should we measure the outcome after they get their degree in economics and their earning power, or how would we look at that?
Mr. Spry.
Chair Hausman, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, it's Scandinavian name. That's right.
I was trying to peek through there. I think with respect to the cost-benefit analysis, there's a difference between a building and then what you actually get, which is a building filled with U of M researchers or U of M employees engaged in outreach. And so off the top of my head, generally, one can sort of look around at prices, and I was mentioning the internal transfer pricing. There's also the external market of if you're going to provide the U of M $100,000 worth of, say, bioscience lab space, you may be able to calculate the value of that lab space based on the discounting of the rental rate of similar space in the private commercial industrial office market. That's one thing. In some ways, I think your comments are sort of pointing perhaps in the direction of the Brandel-Weber Commission, and I think a whole different question, which is to what extent should subsidizing and promoting education be done through state institutions directly, including the capital budgeting process, or to what extent should funding follow students for higher ed? And that's a whole nother can of worms.
Representative Carlson.
I was more interested in, Madam Chair, the I was describing what the inputs were, but I was wondering how you measure the value of that and what you should use. That was essentially my question, what we should use. Because part of what we're talking about, often here we talk about the public good. education being in the public good, whether it's the private sector, the public sector, research. I wasn't thinking of the Brandel Weber approach in terms of how you fund it, but just using examples of how we fund it and how we should measure the benefit part of that cost analysis, I guess, is what I was asking. And I don't want to belabor the point, but if we're going to invest indirectly at St. Thomas, how do we measure the benefit? Or, because it's a larger subsidy, for example, often in the area of research, both in terms of providing space, providing the dollars often for a match for a public, or I mean a private contribution as well for the research, how you measure all that in the long term. Whether we should look at the fact that students who graduate from St. Thomas or the U higher earning power, should that be a part of the cost-benefit analysis? Tougher one, I think, is research, because sometimes it's years and years before you have a breakthrough, if ever. Sometimes best intentions don't lead to a major discovery in whatever they happen to be doing the research.
Representative Rick, well, we'll get the last question, and then Representative Riccobina.
No, Madam Chair, I was just, you know, thinking about Representative Downey's introduction as to why, you know, he wants the bill. And, you know, there's certainly no doubt that and no argument that there's politics involved in the bonding bill. We're all politicians. But the people you've got in your bill... Who's the current Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, Representative Downey?
Tom Hansen.
And, Madam Chair and members, and so Tom Hansen isn't political? What did he do before he was Commissioner of Management and Budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Kavina, I don't know.
I think he might have been the henchman like we have now for the House floor for the Republicans. So, you know, the people you have here, other than the current state economist who's retiring and kind of is pretty neutral right now. Everybody else is a politician. So you're just going to put another step in us being political. But I got a kick out of Mr. Spry's. So you think Canal Park is a state park? That'd be like me saying I go to Mancini's for a cultural experience when I come to the cities, because Canal Park is just a bunch of businesses on the
But I agree with
point.
You. It's a nice place to visit.
Oh, it sure is if you want to buy clothes and everything else, but not to go to a state park. But the point being, Madam Chair, that I don't, this bill really, I mean, you can make a benefit cost analysis anything you want if you're in charge of determining what the answers you want to see if you're in charge of that. So I really don't see the need, and I have no problems as a elected official fighting for what I think are good bonding projects in my district or in your district for that matter, and then having to defend them when I run for re-election. But Madam Chair, while I have the floor, could I tell you how disappointed I am that you moved my little project on today's agenda up ahead of when I got here, because it was like the second to the last thing
I
on the agenda.
I feel terrible because, and I was just trying to do a favor for the guy from International Falls. I thought he had to get back, so I moved because he was an out-of-town person. I moved them up
because
I had to drive back.
I was just coming in the door as they were leaving, and I heard that someone from the Polanyi administration was here to defend why we should spend our money not.
But we will we'll give you an opportunity if you want to speak to that as soon as we conclude this. Members, as you can see from Representative Riccobina and Clark and Gardner and Anderson and Downey, this interest in policy is bipartisan. And I mean, one of the as soon as we conclude here, I'm going to ask Jeff Freeman, and then I'm not sure who from MMB, to just give us a brief reaction. But this isn't unique to this year. We have almost always added policy language in committees or on the floor along the way. And I thought if we had just one meeting where we kind of took a look at it, and if there are people in the interim who would want to spend a little bit of time saying, is there interest in moving a policy bill next year? We've never done that. And it would keep it separate from the idea of the bonding bill, but it it just seemed to me, because we have, this is not just a one-year thing, this has been sort of an ongoing, at least the last 4 years that I've been aware, that there seems to be interest in certain policy directions, and you'll see with Representative Clark, there are three more. So at any rate, we thank you very much.
Yeah,
and
thank you,
if
Madam
we
Chair.
Could just have Jeff Freeman and MMB, and we're not interested in a lot of reaction, but if you would just give us some guidance about where you see the areas of challenge. And the reason I've asked Jeff Freeman is he has just done some of this work, specifically, I think, more on the House File 2909, because it was required by the federal government. So you have more recent information. So maybe we'll start with you. And again, we don't want a lot of time, but if you would just give us some reflection.
Sure.
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Jeff Freeman with the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. We received about $107 million in federal era stimulus funds for clean water and drinking water projects. And those funds, among numerous other requirements, had a requirement to measure and report on jobs created and retained by those funds or for those projects. So we've been at this for about a year now. EPA, I think, went through about two or three false starts in how this was going to be done and trying to set up the parameters. And we eventually got to the point where we felt like we couldn't wait for them, and we kind of plowed ahead on our own and then had to come back and modify some things. But starting with the conclusion is it is a very difficult task to come up with a process to generate reliable, consistent, and meaningful jobs data when you're looking at funding infrastructure projects. Some of the issues that we struggled with and the questions that we tried to deal with, and I'll in no particular order, but each project has one or more prime contractors and numerous subcontractors, and they have workers that are coming and going on a job site all the time. Some may be there for only a few hours, some might be there for a few days, some might be there for a few weeks, others are there for months. And so to try to figure out, well, how many jobs are on that project, that becomes one of the very difficult things to do, is what's the specific number of jobs from all of that activity. You've got the issue, any one contractor has multiple jobs going on at a given time. So the question of, is it a job that's been created, or is it a job that's a new job created, or a job that's been retained? If a contractor has three different jobs going on at once and he hires one worker, was that because of job A or job B or job C? It becomes very subjective and really kind of impossible to determine that. Indirect jobs. We know that there are significant numbers of indirect jobs that would be generated by suppliers and equipment manufacturers that are supplying things for that project. But to try to quantify those indirect jobs, we couldn't think of any way to do it. So we're missing a significant number of jobs in that way. There's also the issue of many of the projects that we fund are a combination of multiple sources of funding. And so, do you count the total number of jobs, even though in our case, the federal stimulus money was only a portion of the total project funding, or do you prorate the jobs in some way? All of those issues became issues for us to try to figure out at the state level, issues for EPA to try to, in order to have some kind of consistency among states, try to develop some procedures I don't know that any of it has been done very satisfactorily, and those are some of the issues. On the cost side, there's significant costs involved with this, really, at all levels. For the local governments, they need to have somebody that sort of compiles the reporting information from the prime contractor and the subcontractors and the engineers and all the rest. Most local governments don't have somebody available to do that, so they end up hiring a consultant to do that, to compile those numbers, submit the reports to us. The contractors, I don't know that there's any way to quantify it, but they certainly, you would expect they're going to put some cost increase into their bid prices to deal with all the extra administrative costs of generating those reports. For agency staff, you know, we're getting the information reports from about 60 projects, so we've got to compile that information at our level, sort through when there's inevitably questions or things that are clearly wrong, and following up on trying to get more accurate information or clearing up those questions has been a significant cost for our staff. And then finally, as I mentioned, for EPA, or maybe in the case of doing at the state level, for MMB to try to develop the protocols and the procedures, so you can compare and compile the jobs from different agencies, different types of projects, different types of programs, and try to put it all together. It becomes difficult at all those levels. Ultimately, it generates a lot of data, but it's, I think it's, you know, a questionable reliability and consistency. And as a state manager, I look at it and have to wonder, you know, what's the value of all that information we've collected and the money that's been spent collecting.
And members, you can see from the audience that this hearing attracted some of the state agencies who would have to implement the policy we put into place. In fact, Representative Rukavina, I didn't even know admin was going to come. They just walked to the table. So clearly, I think that those agencies that have to implement what sounds like good language on paper give us a little bit of a dose of reality. And so we've invited MMB to just briefly give some comments as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy Cardell. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Treasury and Debt Management at MMB. If you want, do you want me to just, Madam Chair, kind of go in order?
Yes, and I think we're interested in just kind of broad generalities, because I think this is a hearing intended to lay out all of those ideas people had this year, and there were a lot of them, and then hear just a little bit of feedback from state agencies about what are the challenges around those.
Sure. So I'm going to start with Representative Gardner's bill, 2182, and apologize first of all to you. I received a fiscal note request today. We will be preparing a fiscal note for this request, but it was not able to be done in time for today's hearing. Some of you that predate my time here in state government will remember, perhaps, that there were some earlier statutory requirements for review and sort of analysis of capital project requests that MMB did previously. It predates me, but the feedback that I got from our capital budget folks that worked on that in the past was that we went through a fairly laborious process, and most of the time that review and ranking was that they were ultimately not paid any attention to. And so consequently, we suggested revisions, which you adopted last year, that really simplified the types of information that we were requesting from applicants for capital project funds. In terms of Representative Gardner's bill, I think that there would be some minimal, there'll be some cost to MMB to do this. I can't say to what that is yet. I'm not sure how at all, and hearing Mr. Freeman talk about the difficulties of estimating jobs and economic activity associated with projects is challenging. And we, too, would be concerned about the quality and the accuracy of the information. I mean, we can probably figure out a way to report anything that anybody gives to us. But the question is how good that information and really is. And so that's where the work that would have to be done by agencies like DEED or by MnDOT and others is important. The next one is House File 2909, and that's Representative Anderson's bill. I'm not going to reiterate the same sort of comments because I think Mr. Freeman has talked quite eloquently about some of the difficulties. We have prepared a fiscal note for the MMB impact, but we also ask that other agencies such as DEED and MnDOT for certain would need to also weigh in on this because we do believe that the majority of the costs associated with this would be borne by agencies that are actually implementing capital appropriations. There also would be a local government cost, which we are not in much of a position to quantify. So I'm going to move on from that one. Representative Downey's bill, 3105. I'm sure that there are some cost implications for MMB, but again, larger implications for agencies and local governments who are presenting projects for consideration. Just some practical implications I was thinking about as I was listening to the testimony and thinking about the time frame for which we solicit and receive agency and local government project requests. In 2008, just to remind you all, in the 2008 Bonney Bill, there were 192 separate appropriations for capital projects that resulted from that one bill. That includes appropriations for which they were for programs, which there are many, many projects that underlie those appropriations. So if you think about that, and then we were thinking about how many requests did we get in 2010? Well, 2009 for consideration in 2010. We received over 160 project requests for local governments, and at least an equal amount. We did not actually total up all of the individual agency requests, but at least an equal amount of agency requests. So in that little compressed period between May and July, when we would be actually reviewing all of those project requests for at least the initial submittal, you're talking about 320 plus analyses potentially. And I just don't know how you would look at that with respect to program appropriations versus project appropriations for sure.
And then, though we're not moving House File 2590 today, that was on an earlier agenda. Mm-hmm. And you've shown us that even a good idea like early cancellation has a cost, and you've shown us the fiscal right. impact of that.
Right. Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, we did. And again, this is the bill that accelerates the cancellation for authorized projects, and we did an estimate based on, as we do for forecast already for debt service, if we were continuing with a $725 million bill in the even years and $140 million bill in the odd years, if the cancellation process was shortened up to 2 years, our expectation is that people would want us to sell bonds more quickly. And so we made an assumption that instead of 15% in the first year, 35% in the second year, 35% in the third year, you know, trailing down over basically a five-year period, that roughly half and half would be sold in the first years. And there is a cost to that compared to the existing forecast. Furthermore, the bill does not discriminate against projects that have been previously authorized, but for which bonds have not yet been sold. And so there would be a substantial amount of projects sitting there that would be subject potentially to cancellation on this coming January 1st, 2011. So we assume that those projects would probably attempt to be accelerated as well. Bottom line, there is a cost to try to make people do projects more quickly, and that's that bonds get issued more quickly and debt service costs go up more quickly.
Thank you for that. Are there any questions from members of the committee? If not, we'll go. Thank you for your testimony. We really appreciate that you're here to help us with these issues.
Thank you.
And the next item on the agenda is House File 2590, Representative Hausman.
That one, Madam Chair, she just spoke to, that was on an earlier, that was in a sense a policy of early cancellation, and she just told us that even something like that, while it sounds like a good idea, they would argue has some cost. But Madam Chair, I would move 3492, and this one we actually do intend to move today.
Representative Hausman moves House File 3492 to your bill, Representative Hausman.
And Madam Chair, along the way in our conference committee, the whole issue of cash flow and when you can use previous bonding authority was discussed. And what we were told is cheaper, because it's been mentioned in a previous bill, I'm looking for to Deb Dyson, I think I'm explaining this correctly, that in fact that is a category of spending that doesn't that can use previously sold bonds. Not that I'm anticipating, a negative outcome, but just because we always like to have another opportunity in the pipeline, I'm moving House File 3492 for that reason, just the HEAP portion. Those numbers are just lifted right out of our conference committee report. That's why those numbers are in the bill. That's in the current conference committee report. So, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
Any questions from committee members for Representative Hausman? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Hausman, any chance that things might be added to this bill as it moves along?
Well, I
Representative
hope
Hausman.
I hope, Representative Erdahl, that we never need this bill.
With that, any further questions? Seeing none, with that, Representative Hausman moves that House File 3492 be recommended to pass and returned to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion carried.
Thank you, members.
And then, as Representative Hausman is coming back, Representative Rukavina, did you have comments on your earlier?
Members, and you know, Representative Hausman, I appreciate the fact that you had accepted my amendment, my Buy American, Buy Local amendment in, I believe, Finance Committee, if I'm not mistaken. Perhaps it was in this committee. I'm saddened by the fact that the Senate took it out of the capital bonding bill, because I think it's good policy for the state of Minnesota to try to keep as much of our tax dollars in the state as we possibly can and in this country as we possibly can. And I don't think there's any unconstitutional things about it, because other states have done it. I believe that was discussed when I wasn't here. But you know, if you think about the first stimulus bill, If I recall correctly, there was about $380 billion doled out when President Bush was still president, when things started happening. I think Gino Pelucci was the gentleman that came out and put a letter to the editor somewhere that maybe we should just give every American, and I think it came to about $4,000, everybody $4,000, every man, woman, child, $4,000. Have them buy something made in the USA or pay part of their house loan off and put that money and watch it turn around in the economy. I think it would have been a good idea, and that was just my reason for introducing the Buy American. I want to thank the steelworkers that brought it to my attention, because they've done it in other states, as I mentioned, and I wanted to see that hopefully $1 billion, if you can keep it in that range, Madam Chair, turn around as much as we possibly could turn it around in our own economy.
And Representative Rukavina, I thought it was carefully worded, the language, and we did also reference the Michigan and Boston handouts that are in your packet. And it did occur to me, though some of these, Representative Mullery has something that, though some of these others I think have sort of bigger cost issues, it occurred to me this one we might want to figure out how it might move separately. So, Representative Mullery.
Well, Madam Chair, you referenced the Boston handout, and I'm not sure what
that came from, but that's a totally different issue than Buy American is a products thing, which is totally different under the Constitution than issues of actual workers. And this case from Boston is an old case before people started realizing the Commerce Clause didn't apply to the issue, and this case is on the Commerce Clause. There's other later cases, federal cases, that apply the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which rule it unconstitutional and specifically distinguish between the two clauses. So the Boston case really is an old case and is not on point at all. So I'm not arguing one way or the other. First of all, I want everybody to distinguish between Buy American, which is a totally different issue under the Constitution, and the other, and I think we just need to look into it before we get into something that would tie the whole bonding bill up in court or something like that.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Rucavina.
You know, if we can't spend our own tax money, how we determine how to spend it as a legislature, something's wrong. But, you know, there's a lot of lawyers in the legislature and a lot of lawyers, you know, that are looking for things to contest. So I don't know if... No, never. Except for Joe. Joe works. He's a good pro bono.
Madam Chair, I'd prefer not to tie up the bonding bill in court this year. I think we need the jobs.
We have three additional, well, actually four, because Jeremy Kalin is here. The other one, there were two that the governor indicated some disagreement with. The one Buy American was one. The other one was the state climate goals. And then you also have in your packet, and I think we're going to hand out the third one.
Yes.
Representative Clark had three issues. You have two of them in your packet, and if you would already take a look at them, maybe while Jeremy, Representative Kalin, I'm sorry, too familiar here. Representative Clark has the healthy flooring one. She has the capital projects bidding, fair share, and then she had the pollution control agency one, and I think that one was actually discussed in the Finance Committee, as I recall. But you begin to see the number of policy ideas that are connected to capital projects. But Representative Kalin is here just to briefly set the context for why the climate change goals were related to bonding. Why did we see it in that context?
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are actually Representative Knuth provisions that she's much more familiar with, but so I'm winging it a little bit, but it's an issue I think we all know fairly well. The provisions that were in Section 28 and 29 on page 59 of what I think was the Conference Committee report, or I'm sorry, from our original bill. Section 1 merely referenced existing statute 216H.02, which are our greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals that we passed as a body 125-9 in my first session in 2007, and at the initiative of the governor, these were I can actually remember that his platform was more renewables, more efficiency, and less carbon, and we responded to his charge, and bipartisanly there were 14 no votes between the House and the Senate, and passed the second strongest position in the state. We're in the country, excuse me. And so as we make our investments and for the long-term future with targets for 2020 and beyond all the way to 2050 to clean up our energy sources and clean up our environment, that it makes sense that for the long-term health, as we make long-term investments, that we align our energy policies, our environmental policies with our infrastructure investments. It's, I think, a very straightforward statement. One other piece of background that I think may be important for the public as well as for you and your committee, Madam Chair, is that the investment community is very much looking to states that are standing by their commitment. China is making investments in the hundreds of millions of dollars a week in clean energy technologies, and it is not only solar, wind, geothermal, and energy
production, but it's often in energy efficiency, which I know this committee has made leadership steps actually all the way back to, I think it was 2001, when the sustainable design guidelines were initially put out to have a 30% below code energy efficiency target that every building has met and exceeded that's been funded out of the capital investment bill. So, you know, to the investment community, they're looking at Minnesota, they're wanting to see that we're continuing on the path, and there are literally $2 to $3 trillion of private capital waiting on the sidelines, wanting to jump in and help make the clean energy economy possible. We're waiting on some federal action. The president's actually meeting as we speak with Lindsey Graham on the subject, and I think that it's urgent that we stay the course and stick to our commitments.
And so if we're serious about the goals we've established as we build our public infrastructure, we relate those climate goals to the bill that builds the public infrastructure.
Exactly. And I think, Madam Chair, you and I, one of the things that you and I share is our conviction that when we have an idea, we stand behind it. And the polling has changed about 7 or 8 points from the high 60s to low 70s now to the high 50s and low 60s on the urgency of addressing this issue. I don't think that it's our job to stick our finger in the wind. I think it's our job to stand by what we believe is the vision for the state, and I think it's important that we do so as we look to the long-term future.
Thank you for coming, and I think there is another committee immediately at 4:30, and so Representative Clark, we have three issues, and I know you have people you'd like to testify, and I have the sense we're going to need to save these for another meeting.
Chair, Representative Champion just came in too. He's part of the discussion and actually the author of the legislation that deals with the targeted employment, green jobs. I was just thinking what Representative Kalin was talking about, but it's anyway ensuring that some of our jobs that we are creating with this wonderful bonding initiative will go to the people who really need it the most, and in some of the communities that are going to be served. So I'm just wondering if we are going to have a bill that deals with the policy, are we?
Well, it does seem that we would have to move it separately because, and then I do think we're going to have to find a Senate author if we're going to move a policy bill on both sides, and I think that's why we've got a little bit of work to do.
Okay. Yeah,
because there hasn't been an interest. There hasn't been this kind of interest on the Senate side, I don't think, in moving policy, and so I think the big question is whether we'll find a willing Senate author.
Yeah, I actually pulled back this bill that deals with the fair jobs issue because I was pretty sure from what we talked about that there was going to be a policy one.
And we would move it. Yeah. It's just if it's not met on the Senate side, that's the problem.
Well, I'll take an assignment to go and make sure we get a Senate out there and work on that. When do you think we might be able to have the discussion about these three items, then, do you think?
Was somebody waiting here to?
Well, yes. I did have several people here.
I just didn't know if I'm sure the next committee is waiting, so we probably can't bring them up anymore, but.
Okay. When do we, there's several people, Jeff Bauer for one, and Representative. Anyway,
I don't know.
I'm just wondering when we might be able to tell them to come back.
It might be next. We try for next Tuesday.
Okay.
Does that?
Okay.
Okay.
Can we get at the top of the agenda?
You'll be the agenda.
Oh, we'll be the agenda.
You'll be the agenda.
In that case, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
And maybe then after your presentation, that would be a committee discussion on. You know, we've had probably a dozen ideas today. And where's the momentum? Do they move separately? Where are their Senate authors?
Okay.
So,
well, thank you. Okay. I appreciate that, and we will really take very seriously the effort to get a Senate author. I think we can do that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much. Meeting is adjourned.
Let's not accept
We have a new spreadsheet, and we have language. And on, that was Thursday, We went over the minimal changes in Minsky and others, and so I will not repeat those, though on your spreadsheet they are highlighted in gray. I will just simply say on under Water and Soil Resources Board, we added in our language one more eligible project, the Bear Lake Watershed, and we increased the amount of money for Moose Lake from 36 to 47.5. And on for the Rochester Civic Center, we increased that. We part of that is on the bottom line. The other is the Ramsey Water Recycling Treatment Plant. Is,
can you give us the line numbers?
381, 382, or 382, 383. So the Ramsey Water Recycling Treatment Plant is down to zero. The Rochester Mayo Civic Center Complex up to 28. If you needed the Bear Lake Watershed, that is line 180. And if you need Moose Lake, that is 47.5. And those are the only changes from Thursday. And then, just as a reminder, we do lift the cap on Vermilion. That is part of this offer. So in this offer, we have included all of the governor's items. We have increased the amount for Moose Lake in this version before you, and we still come in under $1 billion. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, this is the first I've heard about this Ramsey County water.
No, not Ramsey County.
City of
Ramsey.
City of Ramsey. And why was that changed, that dollar amount?
We, as we looked at the priorities, that was perhaps more local than the Rochester Civic Center, which we perhaps had cut back a little too dramatically. Okay. And so, as often happens, you look for, when you can't grow the bill anymore, you look for other lines. Other questions? Representative House?
I don't have any questions, but I have some amendments I would like to offer and explain why I'm going to offer them.
Representative House?
I'll offer the first amendment would be on line 333, the Moose Lake facility, and change it from 47.5 to 60.5.
What line is that?
And Representative House, do you cut other portions of the bill or?
No, I do not. Now I have a total of, I believe, four places I would like to amend the bill and increase the dollar amount. I believe that the governor will not veto the whole bill. So my goal is to get a bill that this committee can agree to pass out and bring to both floors and pass, and the governor will not veto the whole bill.
But he will, Madam Chair, somewhat massacre it? Is that
Senator, I can assure you of this, that I would work very hard with him, and I'd get very angry with him if he were to do any partisan line items or metro-rural line items that weren't fair and balanced across the board.
Representative Howes, were you including, was that the extent of your amendment, or are you?
No, I would go in the Pope Douglas. I can't remember which line that's on. You'll have to give me a second. It's under PCA.
167.
That's 167, and I would put $5 million in there.
$5 million. It is.
$5 million. When I'm done, then you can yell at me and be in shock. And, yeah, no, I know. I'm just doing my job for now. And then the next one would be the Perm Resource Recovery.
That's in.
That's in? Okay, all right. And Fergus Falls Tower Bridge is in?
Yeah.
And then the Anoka, and I haven't found it yet, under transportation.
That's language. No money.
That is just language?
The Ramsey stop in Anoka.
Have I covered it, Jenny, then? Which one don't I have? Well, I talked to Chair Hausman, and she said that the Lanesburg Dam is at the in the list. It will get done, so we don't need language. If that you were to get an indication that that might change, then the language would be just to highlight that with language in the bill. And then that those are the extent of my amendments. And again, I would say to you that I have it on good advice that the governor will not send a letter out tomorrow saying that he's going to veto the whole bill, and I don't believe he will veto the whole bill.
Discussion to the amendment.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Lang.
What we will have here is a situation where the governor can line item down to his bill, get all he wants, line item down to his bill. The only way I'd go along with that is if the governor says, okay, I will sign the bill. Fine. Then let's do this. But under any other circumstances, he has not given any indication, he has not offered us anything for anything that we have given to him. There's been no assurance at all. And now you say he probably wouldn't line item the whole bill. No, but he wouldn't veto the whole bill, but he could line item right down to his bill. And we've seen that before, and I see no reason to expect any different this time, unless he's says different.
Representative Solberg?
I passed for the present time.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, just to that point, I can't speak for the governor on the amount that he would line item veto, but I can reasonably assure you it wouldn't be down to 725.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative
I will. You know, I know that there's been discussions with the governor's office, and we have tried our best to find a number that would satisfy the governor. And as Commissioner Hansen testified last time, it was 725, and he said, well, something different than that maybe towards the end. He never came up with a number. I think both the chairs would have constructed a bill that would have fit if the governor would have given us a number that was compromised. Larry, my difficulty is two things with your proposal. It's not that I don't think that all of us want to do the Moose Lake. I have asked repeatedly from people in high places to tell me what the footprint looked like in 2006 that says the first phase was 44.5, and the second phase was 47.5. Someplace, somehow, somebody has to have a schematic anyway of saying the first phase of Moose Lake is this, the second phase is that. Otherwise, those numbers would not exist. Now, they either don't want to show them to me, the size of the footprint, or they don't exist, and that the plans have changed. I would accept that the plans have changed. I would absolutely accept that the plans have changed. But I would like to know what the original footprint was, what the original plans were, so I have something to compare apples to apples. I can't get it. Somehow or another, someplace, somebody knows what that footprint was like and won't share it with us.
Representative House.
I can somewhat answer that because of the experience I've had in the construction industry, but the numbers you're getting are not bid prices. They're not, we can build it for this. These are prices that would come from the architects and engineers saying, this is probably what it would cost. They fluctuate a lot. I'm not defending the prices. I'm just saying that that's the way it is in the construction industry. We don't know until it's let out for bids, and you get the hard numbers. And obviously, if the bids come in at 47, 48, 49, or even 55,
we don't give them 60.5. We give them what it is to build it. So I think we need to depend more on the bid prices that a contract signed with than on the estimates the architects and engineers put in.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that begs the question then a little bit of what we're doing. In 2006, Phase 1 was estimated at 44.580. I think, appropriated 41.5. And they built Phase 1 for the 41.5. We then allowed them to expend some additional money from themselves. They had asked for 3.2 for architectural drawings for designing a Phase 2. Someone had to have a Phase 1 and Phase 2, at least some partial drawing of it. All I'm asking for is how many square feet they were asking. Was it the infrastructure? Was it infrastructure and beds? I have no idea. But someplace in 2006, there had to be some kind of a determination that the second phase was going to be cost 47.5. Otherwise, it wouldn't be feasible. So, consequently, since I don't know if I'm comparing apples to apples, I agree with you wholeheartedly. But they did the design. Now it's $90 million. And somehow or another, that is just... You know, or the infrastructure is 60.5. Right. I don't know if the infrastructure in 2006 was Phase 2 and was at 47.5 or 7.5. Someone would just show me the footprint of the thing in 2006. I'd at least feel a little bit more comfortable about this. And I understand the difficulties. I think. You know, information is not coming forward.
Any further discussion?
Could I add one more bit of information? And Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying to ruin anything here. I'm trying to help. We could adopt the amendments. We don't have to close the conference committee. That might give you some room to go sit down with the governor and negotiate with him and say, well, this is what one of your Republican colleagues offered. This is part we don't like, and we don't like this, but we're okay with that. That might at least put us at a place where you can sit down with the governor and hammer some things out. And until then, we're really going back and forth saying, well, what do you like, governor? And the governor said, well, you know what I like. But, well, what don't you like? Well, it's your job to pass it. We're just going back and forth, I think. And maybe if we actually had something that we voted on and came to a number on, and again, you don't have to close the conference report by any means. You could stay open for many days. But that would give you the ability to sit down with the governor and say, okay, this is where we're at right now. What do you think?
Madam Chair.
Senator Langstaff.
Representative, I would say that if we were going to do that, we simply not adopt the amendment and sit down with the governor. Because I don't see why in the world we should be giving him what he wants without any assurance at all of what he's going to give us.
The motion is before us. In our original bill, as you saw it this evening, we increased Moose Lake from 36 to 47.5. The amendment would increase that amount to 60.5, and adding $5 million to the capital assistance program, which would take the bonding bill above $1 billion. That is the motion. No further discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
I believe that is not three votes on either side. But it was a good try. Other discussion? Senator Langseth?
I'll move the proposal.
Senator Langseth moves the proposal. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. I'm sorry. This is the changes, but what you have in front of you is the incorporated.
Madam Chair, is this the?
This is the spreadsheet, and then though you have an amendment, it's already incorporated into which, and that's the one that was handed out, right?
the newly engrossed version.
Well, Madam Chair, I would discuss it a little bit. I would say if we pass this and closed it and brought it to the floor, the governor would send a letter saying he'll veto the whole bill.
Any further discussion?
Do we have to adopt the amendment?
No. It's incorporated in the new engrossment that you have. So you have the spreadsheet and the new engrossment. No further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Any further business this evening?
I've got one technical change. I didn't know you were going to do it so fast.
It's
okay. We can do it on the floor.
You can't. This is a competition. I don't think we can.
Madam Chair.
I thought we actually already.
We did. Madam Chair, I talked to Mr. Watson and Jenny just prior to the hearing, and it goes back to the Senator Pappas language that we were changing regarding the Central Corridor improvements through the Capitol area. It's on the it is on the amendment, page 2 at the very bottom of the page.
Right.
It says, to design, construct, furnish, and equip improvements to property along the Central Corridor, light rail tracks as they pass the state capitol on University Avenue in St. Paul. That language, when I spoke to the CAP board, they would prefer that it says improvements to property along the Central Corridor, light rail tracks as they pass the state capitol area in St. Paul, because the improvements will actually turn the corner and go down 12th Street with the improvements to the fence work and the changes to the ornamental poles. So I'm sorry about that. I didn't realize
that. I'm going to suggest that might be a technical corrections bill. Does that work?
Yeah.
Would that work? Technical correction.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Take care of it. Any further business?
Well, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
What is the conference committee report closed then?
The motion was made on that.
We don't have a report yet.
Okay, so that could be tomorrow or whatever. I mean, I would have to again reiterate that the governor would veto the bill in its entirety, and the House would uphold the veto. I just want to make, for the record, I just want to be clear. That's all. I mean, I'm not trying to be.
Madam Chair, is
Senator Lane,
Representative, as long as you're talking to the governor, could you ask him if he could come our way some? I mean, this idea that you give me everything I want, and then I will do whatever I want with your bill is totally unacceptable. It is totally unacceptable.
Mr. Chairman, had you adopted my amendments and not, Madam Chair, Senator, if you had adopted my amendments and not closed the bill, just adopted them, adjourned for the night, I believe the governor probably would have sat down with you and started talking to you.
Well, we've been trying to talk to him for some time.
Well, I believe
all he'd do is send staff people, and when we wanted to send staff people to talk to his staff people, and then they called it off. I mean, the communication here has been really, because I realize he isn't around very much, but it's been horrible.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, I think the communication would have been a whole lot better had we added the amendments, not closed the report. The governor would have then sat down and talked, but there's no point for the governor to talk if he's going to veto the whole bill the way it sits. There's no point to talk.
Well, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Senator Thomasoni.
Madam Chair, it seems to me, Representative Hall, that if he's talking to you, he should be talking to the chairs, and if he's not talking to the chairs, he's talking to the wrong people. And I don't know why you know something that they don't know, but there should be communication with the chairs because they've got the power to make this thing different.
And I think, members, we probably spent more time on Moose Lake than any other item in the entire bill, and I think we've actually arrived at a number we believe in, and that there comes a point where you think you don't want to spend any more money than that on a particular project, and I think that's sort of where the conference committee has arrived. Further discussion? Representative House. I believe that is it. Meeting
Madam Chair. Madam Chair. This document then is the report.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. This is a revisor's copy.
Yes.
Okay.
Don't leave. We're going to sign it right now.
Oh, we do.
Have,
yeah. Oh,
the three copies.
We did.
Right
I didn't
here.
Think we did. We do have a copy.
Okay.
Okay. Meeting is adjourned.